But I believe very strongly that seldom, if ever, should there be a negative vote on the floor of the church. I believe it is extraordinarily serious. I'm going to explain it to you. In fact, the only negative votes that I remember on the floor of the church in 27 years as your pastor were when we voted to withdraw from the Southern Baptist Convention in 1978. It was a private ballot vote, and that was worth fighting over because it had to do with doctrine, truth, and standards. It was the right decision. Why should there not be a negative vote on the floor of the church? Because it starts you down a path somewhere you don't want to go. Listen to this. Here's an article here. Judge enters war between church groups. Peoria. A judge issued an emergency order designed to give both factions of a bitterly divided church access to the sanctuary and let an embattled pastor conduct services without disruption. The pastor had changed the locks because there are a lot of suspicious activities. A fire, interruptions, and other activities precipitated this action today. Conflict arose among the inner city church's 900 parishioners about a year ago. The pastor's opponents objected to what they called his failure as a preacher and several other things and all sorts of things here. Let me read you another one. Church fussing, feuding, fighting is nothing new. I think this is clipped out of the Sword of the Lord, yes. A lady in Pontiac, Michigan carried the idea to a new low. 69-year-old Mae Wiley was upset at not being named head of one of the committees in the church. 65-year-old Verdia Billings was named to the post instead. So May got her gun, loaded it, and went and killed Verdia. Here's another. Deacon's quarrel leaves two dead in Dallas. A quarrel during a deacon's meeting at a church erupted into gunfire that left two men dead and another wounded yesterday in Dallas. The shooting occurred shortly before 1:30 during a meeting among the deacons and a secretary at the Living Testimony Baptist Church. Wow. I talked to a wonderful man this week who said, "Brother Davis, there were no harsh words or bad attitudes in the meeting." And I replied, but the negative vote was the first step in that direction. That was the direction we went. A year from now, this is where we could be. Is there anybody here tonight who's right with God who wants to go there? Do you want your children to be there? Why should there not be a negative vote on the floor of the church? Because of the lost. I looked around the other night to see if there's any lost people here. I was scared to death. Why? Because the lost expect God's people to be different than the world. But those aren't the major reasons, folks. Let me give you the major reason. There should not be negative votes on the floor of the church. Because of the lambs in the flock. I was on my face Wednesday night. I was begging God for the lambs. I was saying, "Oh God, the lambs that are here, spiritual lambs and physical lambs. Spiritual lambs, young converts or young Christians who can't handle things like that. Physical lambs. Betty's asleep." I was going to use her right here. "Betty? You know what? Oh, let me see here. Is it Abby? Right? Come here, Abby. Come here. Abby's my friend. She walks up to me at church all the time. She'll come up to me and she'll just stand and look at me, look at me. I'll be walking around sometime, shaking hands. I'll look around, she'll be standing there looking at me. I'll shake her hand, shake my hand. She'll just keep standing there looking at me. Let me tell you something. When I heard that about, or when I read those articles a while ago, my mind always goes to this, the lambs in the church. You see, in the Chicago City Council meeting, these aren't there. In the Lincoln City Council meeting, these are not there. But in the church, these are here. They're always here. They're always here. And they need to sense a spirit of unity, a spirit of oneness, a spirit of loyalty, a spirit of care, a spirit that the church is all right and we're all moving in the right direction together and everything's all right in my Father's house. And the Bible is so strong on this, it is incredible. Thank you, Abby. You can be seated. Matthew 18, verse 6 says, very plainly, a powerful, powerful verse, whoso shall offend one of these little ones which believe in me, it were better for him that a millstone were hanged about his neck and that he were drowned in the depth of the sea. The Bible says, you don't do anything to damage a little child. My apprentice, Luke, we've been fellowshipping for the year that he's been here. He's just turned 18. He's been in Baptist churches all his life and has lived through three splits in churches. Dirty splits. Bad things. You know what? I'm amazed the young man at 18 even wants to be in church. I'm thinking right now of a man who is very dear to my wife and myself. His father was and is a pastor and a godly man. He sat in a church business meeting and heard his father attacked. The chairman of the deacons stood up and asked for the pastor to resign and leave the church and leave the town. The pastor calmly but firmly said, I can leave this building and I can leave this church, but I can't leave this town. God told me to come here and I can't leave till God tells me I can leave. Lots of people left the church that night and started another church in an old church building in town. A family in the church. In fact, it was the chairman of the deacons. After that service, pulled the 15-year-old pastor's son aside after the meeting and said, now son, what we said in the meeting wasn't meant for you. It was meant for your dad. We still love you and feel the same way we did about you. Later on, that young man said, those people don't understand. If people would criticize my dad like they did to me and to the church after the way my dad has given his whole life for them, I don't have any time for them. Church people are just a bunch of hypocrites. And the worst thing I know of that happened in that church that night was not the angry words that were said. The worst thing that I know of that happened in that church that night was not the split. The worst thing that I know of that happened in that church that night was that a 15-year-old lamb was injured for life. When he turned old enough, that young man walked away from God and the church to never return. And it has been 35 years since that happened. And I remember when it happened. And if I remember correctly, and I know this situation very well, that fella has not darkened the door of a church for over 30 years. Is there anybody here tonight who feels your right to vote as you wish is worth your son? Is it worth your daughter? Is it worth your grandchildren? Is it worth any child in this church? There's more to the story than I just told you. The man who attacked the pastor left the church. his adult daughter in her 20s stayed. Then she gradually became infected with her father's bitterness. Everything the pastor did was wrong. He couldn't do anything right. Everything he did, she criticized. In about 2 years of that, one night, she had played the instrument in a service. She went back and sat down, and the pastor stood up in the pulpit and started preaching. And she sat there and started shaking her head and grumbling out loud in the service about what he was saying. She got very angry. It was visible to the people around her. And then, amazingly, her anger ceased all at once. Now, the details of this story are very accurate, people. You need to understand that. When the service was dismissed, she was still sitting in her seat. Somebody came over to her and tried to talk to her, but she couldn't talk. They tried to help her stand up, and she couldn't stand up. In her anger at the man of God, she had had a stroke on the spot. She never spoke or walked again. She went to a they took her to a doctor the next day. He put her in a nursing home, and she was there 30 years until she died just a few months ago. My wife and I visited her. She long since, way back there, made things right with the pastor and his wife. Figured out some way to communicate, and he and his wife visited her many, 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 many times over 30 years. But the damage was done. As few decisions as possible should be taken to the floor of the church if you want to keep unity in the church. Godly leaders should decide as much as possible in a church. As much as possible. I'm thinking of a church that's within 45-minute drive of here. The preacher is a good friend of mine, or was. He's in heaven now, but he was a good friend of mine for a number of, many years. From the first time I came here, for over 20 years, he and I were good friends, 25 years. He used to tell me, Brother Davis, I don't know how to get out of this mess. He said, one Wednesday night every month, we have nothing but a business meeting the whole Wednesday evening. He said, one night a month, he said, we have to deal with every little detail of everything that the church does in that business meeting. And anybody says anything they want to, and he said, Brother Davis, it is, he said, I dread it. He said, I dread that night every month. He said, it's like, he said, you pray visitors don't come. You pray they don't show up that night so that it's not a disaster and you send somebody to hell. Why vote on anything at all? Because every person is important before God and has a responsibility and a right to understand the will of God for themselves. And also, depending on the church's constitution and structure, some items require the vote of the whole church in order to move forward. How do you protect the preciousness of unity? So that you can have peace, so that you can have power, so that you can move ahead? How do you do that? I'm going to teach you something right here I've never taught before. It's really powerful. I've used it in counseling many times, or several times. Number five, pray that the double elders in the church will exercise wisely the authority given only to them by God. Pray that the double elders in the church will exercise wisely the authority given only to them by God. One of the most important things I know of for a church is that the senior elders in the church be strong, godly men. I will not name them. But we have one or two men in our church who find themselves in a unique position handed to them by God Himself. I refer to them as double elders. Elders are, first of all, the leaders of the church. James 5:14, any sick among you, let him call for the elders of the church, let him pray over him, and so on. Titus 1:5. I left thee in Crete, thou shouldest set in order the things that are wanting, and ordain elders in every city. 1 Timothy 5:17, let the elders that rule well be counted worthy of double honor. 1 Timothy 5:19, and against an elder receive not an accusation, but before two or three witnesses. Make sure if anybody ever accuses a leader in this church to you, that they've got two or three witnesses with you, with them when they do it. Hebrews 11:2, by faith the elders obtained a good report. So elders, first of all, refers to the leaders in the church. But elders also refers to something else. It refers to those who are older. 1 Peter 5:5, ye younger, submit yourselves unto the elder. 3 John 1, the elder to the well-beloved Gaius, whom I love in the truth. 1 Timothy 5:1, follow me carefully now, gives to older leaders, older elders, a special power. It says, rebuke not an elder, but entreat him as a father, and the younger men as brethren. I take that very seriously. There are men in this church who have come to me and said, Brother Dace, you ever see anything in my life that shouldn't be there? I want you to rebuke me. And I've said, I'm sorry, I'll never do it. It will never happen. Why? Because you are biblically an elder, and I have a command, rebuke not an elder. I'll entreat you. I'll talk to you. But I will never rebuke you. I wouldn't dream of doing that. Rebuke not an elder. But a double elder, one who's been a godly leader and also is older, by virtue of his years of humble leadership and by virtue of his age, is doubly unrebukable. And also has the double power to rebuke almost anyone else in the church who may start to get out of line. A young preacher, if I called his name, most of you know him, called me recently. He was dealing with a problem with a man in his church. The man's accusations against this young pastor's preaching were some of the most ridiculous I've ever heard in my whole life. The man, let me tell you what it was. Listen to this. This is crazy. Can you believe a man would say this? This man is really serious. And he was a leader in the church. He finally left, which was probably the best thing. The man said that a preacher should never preach from the Bible to tell people how to live, because that would be works. And those works would not be righteous. That man's wife was sitting in church taking notes on a sermon one day when her husband reached over and wrote the word, capital letters, works, right across the paper. I mean, it would have been humorous if it hadn't been true. In fact, most stories like this, when they're told to other people, are humorous. I'm going to tell you, this pastor called me. He wasn't in humor at all. I said, you got to be kidding. He said, no, Brother Davis, this is serious. He said, I'm having to develop a whole sermon to answer this man's charges. He said, he's infecting the church. He said, what do I do with this man? I said, you need to find the double elder in your church and get his help to deal with that man. Find the double elder in the church and tell him what the problem is. He has the power to rebuke that man. You don't. You may not have, because he's older than you. One of the greatest men of God I've ever known in my life was Evan Bainham. If you want God to bless you and your family, go visit his widow, Miss Penny, in the nursing home sometime. Thank God for the Millers taking care of her all the time. I can't imagine what y'all's reward's going to be in heaven. I'm a little jealous of you. Brother Bainham was sent here by God in the 1980s to spend his last years on earth with us. What a man of God. He'd forgotten more than I'll ever know. It refreshes my spirit just to think about him. He had started and pastored several churches in his lifetime. How honored and humbled I was to preach his funeral. I miss him. I can't tell you how I miss hearing him pray. I lost my dad, and I lost Brother Bainham in 3 months. And it's like, I can't describe to you the loss I felt. It's like it's never been replaced. And I know lots of you pray for me, and I thank God for that. I still remember my last visit with Evan Bainham. I still remember walking in there, and I'd visited, and I had to go somewhere, and I said, Brother Bainham, I'll pray with you. Can I pray with you? And he said, sure. And I stood there. He's in a wheelchair. I feel like Moses standing on holy ground just telling this story. He's in a wheelchair. I held his hand, leaned over, and prayed. And I started. He was dazed from his death. I started to let go of his hand when I said amen and move away. And he gripped my hand and pulled me to the floor.
and reached over with his other hand and did this. And prayed for me for about 10 minutes. I felt like I'd walked into the Holy of Holies. I felt like I was looking at the Ark of the Covenant itself. I tell you, the man of God, I miss him like you can't imagine. A few months before he died, we had a problem in this church. It should not have been as big a problem as it was, but it soon escalated into something massive. It was this close to coming to the floor of the church, and we desperately were seeking for a way to keep that from happening because of what I said to you a while ago. A group of men met, and it was decided that whatever this group said would be followed. I was allowed to speak first. Then every other man there was also allowed to speak. I really had no idea how it would turn out. I did know that I had obeyed God the best I knew how. Incidentally, some of you are remembering this, and you'll be happy to know that the key people involved who stayed in the church eventually came and apologized. One of those families did so in the last few months, and we had a wonderful, sweet, tearful time of rejoicing together just in the last few months. In that group that night, several men spoke. And the future of the whole church and my ministry here and my leadership was hanging on a thread until it became Evan Bainham's turn to speak. I was absolutely astounded. I heard and felt authority come out of that man that I did not even know existed on the earth in any church, much less in the church where I was the pastor. Brother Bainham was a double elder in every right and righteous sense of the word. He'd been serving God all his life. He'd started all those churches. Some of them were large churches. And here he was here. He'd teach Sunday school occasionally. And y'all remember what he did. Y'all remember Brother Bainham? Am I right? Was he a man of God? Can I tell you a secret? Brother Bainham hated the term potluck. Did y'all notice that all the years Brother Bainham was here, I quit using that term out of deference to him. If I would forget and use it, he would come to me and very kindly shake my hand and say, "Pastor, there's no such thing as luck. It's not a good term." And he was very kind about it, very gracious. And I told my wife, I said, I got to remember not to use that term. I don't have any problem with it. I don't believe in luck either, but, you know, I don't have any problem with it. After he went to heaven, I thought, well, it's all right. I'll just use it again. But out of deference to him, I just quit using the term. But the Bainham was a double elder in every right and righteous sense of the term, and in that room that night, his clarion words of scriptural exposition were unchallengeable and unrebukable by any other man present. From that point on, the church began to recover, and I understood a key reason why God had sent Brother Bainham to us. Number six, you want to protect the preciousness of church unity so that you've got the power of peace so that you can move forward for God. We must all continually seek to surrender our rights. Would you look at Philippians chapter 2? Nobody had a right to demand his rights like Jesus did. And yet, what did he do? He gave up his rights. Chapter 2, verse 5, "Let this mind be in you, which was also in Christ Jesus, who being in the form of God thought it not robbery to be equal with God, but made himself of no reputation and took upon him the form of a servant." Here's the King of Kings and the Lord of Lords. Here is the highest God of the universe. "Made himself of no reputation, took upon him the form of a servant and was made in the likeness of men." He emptied himself. Not of his deity, but his right to be recognized as deity. No person who ever lived had as much right to be respected and honored as the Son of God, but they spit in his face and he never said a word. He was the only one in the upper room that day who had a right to have his feet washed. But he rose, took a towel, girded himself, went around the room and washed everyone's feet. Can I make this clear?
Jesus yielded his rights, that doesn't mean he yielded truth. And never once did he yield the will of God. I must tell you plainly, when I sense clearly something is the will of God, I cannot and must not yield. That's the reason in 1978, our church voted to leave the Southern Baptist Convention. I knew there would be negative votes. We took a ballot vote. There were negative votes. We voted to withdraw. And I said, it's all right. This is the will of God. We got to do it. It was the will of God. You know, there are other things not nearly as important as that. Church budget needs to be voted on by the whole church. That's the reason we do that. But I've never seen the church budget we've ever introduced that if somebody came and challenged some item on that church budget, I'd probably change it. I'd probably try to change it. I may go back to the budget committee. It's just not as weighty. You know, there's no test for a church like a building program. Man, you wouldn't believe. Past few days, every pastor I've talked to that I've just said, hey, we broke ground this week. We're starting up with a building. They said, you're kidding. God help you. God give you grace. I'm talking about we must all continually seek to surrender rights. Here's what I've heard in the last few weeks. The church has got too much money sitting aside. The church doesn't have enough money. The building isn't large enough. The building is too small. The people have sacrificed all they can. The people haven't sacrificed enough. We don't need a kitchen at all. If we don't have a kitchen, I'm not going to give to the building at all. You know what you're hearing? You're hearing rights in relation to temporal things. Now, I want to challenge you to do something tonight. If you've only been given to the building because of what you expect you and your family will get out of it, then stop right now giving to the building. Then fall on your face before a holy God and ask God to forgive you for your selfishness and ask God what He wants you to do sacrificially for His glory and for the sake of others. How has this church gone so many years without a negative vote spoken out on the floor of the church by yielding rights? Almost always we announce ahead of time what the items are coming before the church. Those things are prayerfully and carefully taken through the deacons and perhaps other leaders. They are never, ever brought to the floor of the church unless the leadership is in 100% agreement. I don't ever remember an exception to that. If people have a problem with those things, they have the opportunity to ask questions or share their feelings ahead of time. If I know that someone feels strongly enough that they're going to vote no on the floor of the church, there have been many times it was never brought up at all. Period. Sometimes it waited 2 or 3 months and the person would come to me and say, oh, Pastor, it's all right, just go ahead and do what you need to do. Over the years I've had people say, Pastor, I don't agree, but you and the leadership of the church feel this is right, I just won't vote at all. You know what they're doing? They're saying, we won't smash that, we'll work to keep it. And we'll yield our rights so that we can keep it. Jack Howells told about having a deacon who disagreed with him. Came to him and talked to him about it. Dr. Howells said, Brother, I love you, but I really feel like this is God's will. The deacon went back and made the motion that they do what it was. He told about having a deacon who was in a deacon's meeting and almost all the decisions at First Baptist Hammond, largest fundamental church probably in the history of the world. Almost all the decisions are made really by the deacons. Did you know that that church of several thousand people doesn't hardly vote on anything? And did you know when they do, they don't give chance for a negative vote? Why? You got several thousand people. How's church going to keep moving? How's church going to keep growing if you've got that going on? He had a deacon who came to him and said, Pastor, I don't agree with this. You know what, you're my pastor, and I love you, and I've been on the deacon board, And I can sense I'm going to get upset with you if I stay on the deacon board, and I love you too much to do that, so I'm just going to resign. He wasn't upset. He said, I don't want to get upset. What was he saying? I'm going to do whatever I have to do to keep that unity so that we have the power of peace so that we can move forward. Do you know when the last big problem was in this church that I remember? And do you remember what it was over? It was in 1992, and it was over that big screen TV behind there. Y'all remember that? Remember that? It almost turned into a fight. It's unbelievable. We had forgotten to put in, we had not put enough money in the budget to take care of that extra expenditure, which was a little over $2,300 is what it was. We realized we needed it. We needed it for youth conference. In fact, part of the problem then was this. We just don't think you'll ever have any use for that thing. I'm serious. We can't see what you're going to use it for. And I said, well, we're going to use it for this and this and this. And I think there'll be a whole lot more reasons why we use it. And we really need it. We had a man who finally came to me. And he was really, he just could not see us spending that money for that. Incidentally, you know what we've done to solve that problem since then? We put more money in new equipment than we need on the budget, so that we don't ever have to bring one little item back to the church anymore. At least since then, we haven't needed to. So, anyway, finally he said to me, Pastor, I love you. Why don't you just vote on this tonight? I just won't be at church tonight. You know what? I love him, and he was welcome at church that night, but I respected him because he was working at keeping the unity there so that we could keep peace, so that we could have power. Now that was fine. You see, we were not publicly divided, and the testimony of Christ was not divided, and the lambs in the flock were not damaged, and frankly, 10 years later, most of you didn't even know about it and didn't even remember it. See, it didn't matter. You see that? It didn't matter. Last Wednesday night, one of the few times in many years we've not been in total unity. The reason there was such a long pause after the vote on Wednesday night is because I was standing here trying to figure out how to undo the vote we had just taken. But I realized that we could potentially cause more damage and more distress by trying to undo it than by just letting it stand. But I got to tell you something here, folks. Buildings don't matter. I'm going to say it again. Buildings don't matter. I'm going to say it again until I get a riotous amen. Buildings don't matter. They are hunks of concrete, wood, and steel, and porcelain. The ministry that building will produce does matter. And that is the reason we must press forward and do what God has for us to do in this area. I need to apologize to y'all for something. I'm serious. Thank God for a faithful, loyal assistant pastor who helped me understand this. Too many times over the last 2 or 3 years, I've stood up and foolishly said, I don't personally care whether we build this building or not. I thought I was somehow or other in my pea brain that it would help. That didn't help. It hurt. And I'm asking your forgiveness. Will you forgive me for saying that? Now hear me clearly tonight. I believe, as your pastor, as much or more than I did when we built this present building, that the building of that building is God's will for this church for now. I just said it. The contract is signed, the ground is broken, the construction has started, and the building is going, by God's grace, with God's help, it's going to be built. If you don't have enough faith to see that, borrow some of mine. Unity matters. And the only way to keep unity is by the yielding of rights. I've tried to think of every right I could yield so we can do the will of God and build this building. I've had people say, well, you know, we'd think it was, if you had everything, if you had all the money, Then you could build the building. But you know, there are a bunch of things in the Bible that didn't happen until people got in motion first. Until the ark was built, the animals didn't come. Until Abraham stood on the mount with the knife in his hand, the ram didn't show up in the bush. Until Moses went before Pharaoh and said, "Let my people go," there weren't any plagues. Until the children of Israel stepped in the Jordan River, the water didn't part. Until the people walked foolishly 7 times around the wall, 7 days around the wall, and the 7th day, 7 times around the wall, till they did that, the walls didn't fall down. Within a few weeks, we'll know whether we have sufficient funds to finish the contract we've signed to build the building. I'm telling you, this is God's will. Did y'all hear me say that? I said, this is God's will. I said, this is God's will. I said, this is God's will. And at some point, if necessary, I'm going to begin refusing my salary from the church. If necessary. I said, this is God's will. When I'm convinced something is God's will, I'll do anything. If necessary, I will also personally come up with all the rest of the money that's needed. If nobody else gives anything, I'll give it all. In case you're wondering, I have $1,200 in a saving account in the bank. But I own a piece of property, and the will of God means more to me than my piece of property. And if there's 100 people lined up at my door telling me they're against it, we'll still vote. In matters that are not matters of conviction, I've waited on people and will probably do so in the future. But we also have to remember that the church cannot slow down too much because the lives and souls of men are at stake in everything the church does. How do you protect? Good night, I've been preaching an hour and a half. I thought this was a 55-minute sermon. You folks are so good. How do you protect the preciousness of unity? You don't wait till it's lost or in danger to realize how precious it is. You lose it, you're in trouble. This church has had wonderful, precious, Spirit-filled unity so many years. We dare not take that for granted now. That unity that was prayed down the other night by God's people, thank God for that. We don't want to let that go at any price. Secondly, we must remember the church belongs to Jesus, not the people or the pastor. Thirdly, learn to judge between that which is worth fighting over and that which is not. Fourth, as few decisions as possible should be taken to the floor of the church. Fifth, pray that the double elders in the church will exercise wisely the authority given only to them by God. Sixth, we must all continually seek to surrender rights. And seventh, we must never forget who the enemy is. I have no enemies here. If anybody here, And I don't know of anybody who feels that way. Thank God I don't. I don't know of anybody here who feels like they're my enemy. And I'm going to tell you, I don't feel like I'm your enemy. We've got to remember who the enemy is. Who is the enemy? Satan. One who wants to get us to smash that. That's right. He'll use me. He'll use you. He'll use anybody he can. There's an interesting thing in Judges chapter 20, verse 11. As the children of Israel were going up against the tribe of Benjamin, which had become morally filthy and perverse. And the Bible says they were knit together as one man. The cause of destroying evil united them. That ought to do it for us too. Clarence Sexton, great preacher down in Tennessee, was on an airplane. A stewardess offered a man in the seat in front of him some food and drink, and the man declined politely, saying, "No, thank you, I'm fasting." Dr. Sexton slipped up later and sat down next to the fellow, thought, sure, he must have been a Christian, introduced himself and asked if he was a Christian, and the fellow said, "No, I'm a priest in the Church of Satan." He talked further and found out that the fellow had a vow, along with several others, to fast 2 days a week for the rest of his life, asking Satan to cause 200 Christian pastors a year to fall into sin. We must never forget who the enemy is. Remember the story I started with? Remember the fight over who's going to trim the hedge or whether it's going to be cut down or what? This is serious, folks. This was an independent Baptist church. Within an hour and a half of where I'm standing right now, they fought on the floor of the church till 10:30 at night. This man writes, "One Sunday as I pulled up beside the church to park, I noticed the shrubs were cut completely down and a no parking sign was posted. When I inquired as to what happened, I was told that three of the men did come Saturday morning and cut the shrubs to the ground, only to find when they finished that the shrubs didn't belong to the church at all. They belonged to the grocery store next door, and the store was upset that the church cut the shrubs down and posted a no parking sign, 'Stay away from us now.' Years ago, the small son of a South Dakota wheat farmer wandered off from the family home and got lost. All through the night and the next day, they looked in vain for the boy, and finally on the third day, somebody suggested that they join hands and walk through the wheat field and try to find him with all their hands joined together. After a while, one of the members of the search party stumbled over the lifeless body of a little boy and hollered and cried for everybody to come. And the father came in a run to where his son was and picked up the motionless body of his boy and cried out, 'Why didn't we join hands sooner?' That's the joining of hands. That's the yielding of rights. It's fragile. It's given to us by the Holy Spirit. It produces an incredible power of peace that allows us, if we will guard it diligently, to move forward for God." Would you bow with me, please?